How does an initial public offering for a rocket company accidentally crater the price of gold? And what do a 27-year-old mayoral candidate in Rhode Island and, like, a woman living with nuns in New York City have in common with the European Central Bank?
I mean, it sounds like the setup to a really bizarre riddle, right? But it's the reality of the global economy right now.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are so thrilled to have you with us. Our mission today is to kind of connect the dots across a truly massive stack of global news. I mean, we're talking war, macroeconomics, sports, space, the housing crisis.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It is. And we want to help you understand how these like massive global shocks are literally trickling down to everyday life and, you know, how humanity is simultaneously looking to the stars in the stadium for an escape.
It's this vast web of cause and effect. And mapping it out reveals some incredibly surprising connections about how our world actually functions under pressure.
Exactly. Now, before we jump in, a really quick note to you, the listener. Today's sources include some highly charged political actions from multiple countries, so including the U.S. and Iran. We want to explicitly state that our goal here is never to take a political side. We are simply here to impartially report the facts contained in our source material to help you understand the current global landscape.
Right. We are strictly looking at the mechanics of the situation, you know, analyzing the board rather than rooting for a specific piece.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We're currently seeing a dizzying amount of whiplash on the geopolitical stage. Like, how do we even make sense of a situation where leaders are threatening massive military strikes one minute and then turning around and announcing peace deals the next? Looking at the U.S. and Iran, the signals are just completely contradictory.
What's fascinating here is the sheer disconnect between the high-level political rhetoric and, well, the gritty reality on the ground. If you look at the timeline over just the last few days, U.S. President Trump threatened to bomb Iran for a third consecutive night. And not just a generic threat, you know, he specifically mentioned seizing the Karg Island oil hub.
Which is, I mean, an enormous escalation. Karg Island handles the vast majority of Iran's crude oil exports, right?
Exactly.
If you seize that, you aren't just attacking a country, you are completely bottlenecking global energy supplies.
Precisely. I mean, it would fundamentally alter global energy markets overnight. But then, almost immediately after that threat, the strikes were called off. The narrative shifted entirely. The claim was that a deal had been brought to the highest level of Iranian leadership, approved, and could be signed in Europe this weekend alongside Vice President J.D. Vance.
But wait, but the sources from Iran are completely rejecting that narrative.
Yeah, entirely.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Esmail Bakai, he went on state television to say nothing has been finalized and that those claims are just purely speculative. So we have this high-stakes geopolitical theater happening in the press, but what's actually happening outside those press briefing rooms?
Well, the ground truth is undeniably tragic. While the rhetoric bounces back and forth, the U.S. blockade continues to be enforced. And there is a very real human cost to that. We just saw reports that three Indian sailors were killed when the U.S. fired on vessels in the Gulf of Oman to, you know, maintain that blockade.
Wow. And Iran is actively retaliating, right? Like,
Sure.
they aren't just absorbing this pressure.
No. They are pushing back aggressively. Iran has targeted U.S. bases in Kuwait, Bahrain, and Jordan. This isn't just posturing anymore. It's an active, expanding regional conflict. And the economic domino effect of this kinetic warfare is staggering. The immediate casualty of conflict in the Middle East is always the same thing:
Oil prices.
oil prices. We are in the middle of a massive oil shock.
Which, I mean, that trickles down into absolutely everything.
Yeah.
When transport gets expensive, the goods being transported get expensive. And that brings us to the central banks, which I always find this part confusing, so maybe you can help me out here. The European Central Bank just hiked interest rates to 2.25%, specifically because of this war-driven inflation. But how does raising the cost of borrowing money in Europe stop an oil shock caused by a war in the Middle East? Like, what's the logic?
Well, it doesn't stop the oil shock itself. It's a blunt instrument. Central banks, they can't produce more oil, right? So they try to crush the demand for oil. By raising interest rates, the European Central Bank is making it more expensive for businesses to expand and for consumers to borrow. They are deliberately slowing down the entire European economy so people buy less stuff, which hopefully, you know, brings prices down.
Wow. It's like realizing your car is running out of gas, so instead of finding a gas station, you just let the air out of your tires so you can't drive as fast.
That is a surprisingly accurate way to put it. And this isn't just Europe, by the way.
Right.
Not at all. In Japan, wholesale inflation just hit 6.5%.
Yeah.
And the Bank of Japan is fully expected to raise rates to a 30-year high of 1%. And they're navigating this while their governor, Kazuo Ueda, is hospitalized.
Wait, hospitalized?
Yeah, with an infection, leaving a massive leadership vacuum during a critical economic pivot. And if you want to see that, like, the immediate consumer impact of all this, look at Brazil. Aviation fuel just spiked 40% because of this global instability, severely driving up the cost of domestic flights.
So the global economic machine is under immense pressure. But looking at our sources, our political and democratic institutions are also buckling. I'm seeing this theme of, like, institutional strain absolutely everywhere.
Yeah, it's a symptom of the same systemic overload. When the macro environment gets this hostile, the cracks in the foundation really start to show. For example, in the UK, Defense Secretary John Healey just resigned.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the government offered a $15.5 billion defense budget, and he demanded $18 billion. When he didn't get it, he just walked away, citing an inability to protect the country under those constraints.
Which tells you exactly how seriously they're taking the current global threat level. I mean, you don't resign over a budget dispute unless you genuinely believe the current systems can't handle the coming storm.
Exactly. And we see logistical breakdowns, too. Look at South Korea. Police just raided 7 National Election Commission offices.
For what?
Because they literally ran out of ballots during local elections.
You're kidding.
No, I mean, that is an unprecedented logistical failure for a modern democracy.
And in the U.S., the institutional friction is just as palpable. President Trump is pushing Congress to pass a resolution to legally void his first-term impeachments, something legal scholars argue doesn't even have a constitutional framework. Simultaneously, he's facing so much pushback on his intelligence director nominees that he had to replace Bill Polt with Jay Clayton just to find a path to confirmation.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, all of these events, from the Gulf of Oman to the halls of Congress, are creating an incredibly expensive, highly volatile world. And that burden ultimately falls on the average citizen.
Which, okay, that brings us from the macro reality of central banks and defense budgets to the micro reality of your daily life. Okay, so wait, let's go back to that central bank mechanism you mentioned earlier. If central banks are hiking rates to fix inflation, they are making mortgages more expensive. Landlords pass those costs on to renters. So aren't the people managing the global economy just making it incredibly difficult for everyday people to afford basic shelter?
Yes. The affordability crisis is fundamentally reshaping how people live and who they vote for. It's not an economic abstract anymore. It is altering the physical fabric of our cities.
I mean, look at housing. Our sources highlight 2 incredibly stark examples of this squeeze. In Providence, Rhode Island, you have a 27-year-old named David Morales running for mayor. His entire platform is built around rent caps. He's turning housing into a literal generational battle line because young people are entirely priced out of their own neighborhoods.
And if you can't change the policy through politics, people are forced to take drastic, almost, I don't know, medieval measures. Look at the story of Katie Redick in New York City. She was facing rents of $5,000 a month just for a basic apartment.
Right. So what does she do? She moves into a convent.
Exactly. She moved into a convent in Chelsea. She traded her independence for cheap rent and hot meals, living under an 11 p.m. curfew mandated by the nuns just so she could afford to exist in the city.
That is wild. A young professional in one of the world's financial capitals racing home like Cinderella to beat a curfew because the housing market is entirely broken.
It really is.
But surely there are safety nets. Like, I'm looking at our notes on microfinance. For years, we were told microfinance was the magic bullet for poverty. You know, you give a shoestring entrepreneur a tiny loan, they buy a sewing machine, start a business, and pull their family out of poverty.
Right, you're referring to the concept that won Muhammad Yunus the Nobel Peace Prize back in 2006. The theory was beautifully optimistic, you know, doing good while doing well. Provide capital to the unbanked, and human ingenuity will do the rest.
But the Wall Street Journal report we have here paints a very different picture. Why is this system failing now?
Because it fundamentally misunderstood the mechanics of poverty under extreme economic stress. Comprehensive academic studies show microfinance has largely failed to dent global poverty. The mechanism breaks down because desperate people rarely use these tiny loans to start businesses.
What do they use them for?
They use them to survive. They pay for immediate medical expenses, food, or fixing a leaky roof.
Which means the loan isn't generating any new income to pay itself back.
Precisely. They consume the capital just to stay alive, and then they get trapped in a horrific repayment crisis.
Yeah.
In Latin America right now, some interest rates on these microloans are currently topping 100%.
Oh my God, 100%.
Yeah, we are seeing it lead to mass homelessness and tragically a surge in suicides in places from Latin America to Asia due to predatory collection practices.
So capital is actively punishing the people at the bottom. But here's where the contrast becomes almost cartoonish. While everyday people are fighting for survival or moving into convents, massive luxury developments are just accelerating.
Oh, the flow of capital is highly selective. For example, Jared Kushner's firm is currently pushing forward with a $5 billion luxury hotel project on a protected, pristine beach in Albania.
And I'm assuming the locals aren't exactly rolling out the red carpet for this.
Not at all. Thousands of Albanians are marching daily. They are protesting the environmental degradation and unchecked development, putting immense pressure on Prime Minister Edi Rama. It highlights a massive global friction point, right? Capital wants to build luxury playgrounds, while locals just want sustainable living conditions.
Okay, so the world feels incredibly heavy right now. Geopolitics are terrifying, the institutions are shaking, and the cost of living is crushing. When reality gets this grim, humanity historically turns to spectacle for escape. And right now, we have the ultimate spectacle, the 2026 World Cup.
Yeah, the timing is kind of perfect.
But it's like we're throwing a massive global party inside a greenhouse. How can elite athletes even function when their bodies are fighting off this level of heat?
It's the physical collision of our desire for distraction with the unavoidable reality of our changing climate. The World Cup just kicked off in North America with this massive, beautiful spectacle at Mexico's Estadio Azteca. You have Shakira, J Balvin, huge crowds.
Yeah, and Mexico beat South Africa 2-0, with Julian Quiñones scoring the very first goal. And you have legends like Lionel Messi and Kylian Mbappe chasing down Miroslav Klose's all-time record of 16 World Cup goals.
It's pure magic. It's exactly the distraction the world wants.
But the climate is aggressively intruding on that magic. El Niño has been officially confirmed, and meteorologists are warning it could be the strongest since records began in 1950. In Brazil right now, data shows 2 out of 3 cities are utterly unprepared for the massive floods the system will bring.
That's terrifying.
And at the World Cup itself, 97 out of the 104 matches are facing extreme wet bulb heat dangers.
I want to pause on that, actually, because wet bulb temperature is a really terrifying concept. For you listening who might not be familiar, wet bulb temperature isn't just a measure of how hot the air is. It factors in heat, humidity, and wind. It essentially measures how well the human body can cool itself down through sweating.
Right. And if the humidity is too high, your sweat can't evaporate.
Exactly. The cooling mechanism breaks. You literally begin to cook from the inside out, regardless of how much water you drink.
That's the exact biological threat. And sports scientists are raising massive alarms. There's a match coming up in Guadalajara, Mexico, where South Korean star Sun Heung-min is scheduled to play at a high altitude that faces a 70% chance of performance-impairing dangerous heat. We are demanding that the most elite physical specimens on Earth push their bodies to the absolute limit in an environment that is actively fighting their biological ability to survive.
But we love watching people push past limits. I mean, look at the NBA. The New York Knicks just pulled off a miraculous 29-point comeback against the San Antonio Spurs. It's the biggest comeback in NBA Finals history.
Yeah, that was insane.
For a brief moment, you have a completely divided city united by the sheer grit of athletic drama. We want the miracle.
We do want the miracle. But this raises an important question. What happens when the natural limits of the human body or the climate won't allow for the entertainment we demand? We start engineering our way around it. Take UFC star Conor McGregor.
Oh, yeah. He's returning to the octagon 5 years after a gruesome leg break, and he looks massive, completely physically transformed.
It looks like a miraculous recovery, but an investigation reveals he allegedly used banned performance-enhancing drugs to make this return happen. And the detail that stands out is that he supposedly did this under the care of Neil Eletrak.
Wait, Eletrak, he's one of the most famous sports doctors in the world. He treats A-list Hollywood stars and elite pro athletes.
Exactly. This wasn't some back alley operation. This was top tier medical engineering. It suggests that when reality, whether it's an aging body, a broken leg, or a warming planet, gets in the way of the spectacle, we're increasingly willing to use chemistry and engineering to fake the miracle.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because if we are talking about using engineering to escape the limits of our reality, that brings us to the ultimate escape, space. So what does this all mean for the global financial markets?
Right.
Usually when there's a global war, when the Middle East is in conflict and inflation is running hot, investors flock to safety. I would expect the price of gold, the ultimate historical safe haven, to be through the roof. Why on earth is it tanking?
It's a brilliant question, and the underlying mechanism tells us everything about the current psychology of global wealth. Mm-hmm. Gold just hit a six-month low, dropping down to $4,022 an ounce. It's on course for its worst quarter in a decade. Why? Because an economic phenomenon called a liquidity drain.
Okay, I need an analogy for this, because it's hard to visualize billions of dollars shifting around.
Think of global investment capital like the water pressure in your house. Normally, water flows steadily to all the different faucets. Some goes to tech stocks, some goes to real estate, and a steady stream always goes to gold for safety. But suddenly, someone installs a massive, industrial-sized fire hydrant in the front yard and opens it all the way.
So the pressure drops everywhere else. The water stops flowing to the gold faucet because it's all rushing out of the new hydrant.
Exactly. And that massive fire hydrant is SpaceX. SpaceX has just gone public in what is now the largest initial public offering in history. They raised $75 billion from the market, reaching a staggering valuation of $1.77
trillion. $1.77
trillion.
I mean, that is larger than the GDP of most countries on Earth.
It makes Elon Musk a trillionaire. His early backer, Antonio Gracias, is set to make $68 billion on this IPO alone. Institutional heavyweights like BlackRock put in a $5 billion order just to get a piece of the action. So, to answer your question about gold, investors are aggressively dumping their safe haven assets. They're selling off their gold to scrounge up the cash needed to buy SpaceX stock.
That is profound. For thousands of years, gold has been the ultimate hedge against earthly chaos. If an empire crumbles or inflation spikes, you hold gold. But right now, the wealthiest investors are looking at wars in the Middle East, a rapidly warming climate, and failing institutions, and they are saying, I don't want to hedge against this. I want to buy a ticket out of here.
They are betting their capital entirely on the future of humanity in space. The promise of an interplanetary future is completely overriding the traditional fear of earthly instability. The sheer scale of the SpaceX IPO literally drained the liquidity out of the gold market.
Wow. Let's take a breath and recap this journey we've been on. We started at the very top of the global structure, tracing the geopolitical shockwaves from the U.S.-Iran conflict. We saw how the threat of disrupted oil bottlenecks global energy, forcing central banks to hike rates and slow down economies.
Right. And we broke down the mechanism of how those macro decisions squeeze everyday people, driving up the cost of borrowing, until young professionals are forced to run for office on rent caps, or literally move into convents, just to survive in a city.
Yeah.
And we saw how supposed safety nets like microfinance break down into the reality of survival economics.
Yeah. From there, we looked at how humanity tries to distract itself from that heavy reality through massive sporting spectacles, even as the changing climate and extreme wet bulb temperatures make those very spectacles physically dangerous for the athletes.
And finally, we saw the ultimate pivot, how the world wealth is quite literally betting on the stars, graining money out of traditional safety nets like gold to fund the ultimate engineering escape route off the planet entirely.
Which leaves you, the listener, with one final thought to mull over as you look at the headlines this week. When we look at athletes pushing through dangerous wet bulb temperatures just to entertain us, people moving into convents because basic housing is unaffordable, and the global economy pouring trillions of dollars into leaving the planet, we have to ask ourselves, are we successfully adapting to an increasingly chaotic world, or are we just funding incredibly elaborate ways to run away from it?
It's a perspective shift that connects the sports page directly to the financial page. Thank you so much for joining us for today's deep dive. We hope it helped you see the underlying mechanics connecting the events shaping our world.
Until next time, keep questioning everything around you.